Brendan, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
So, Brendan, you've written about World War II along sort of the Pacific theater before, but this was your first trip to the Aleutians back in 2009. So how did you end up on Kiska in the first place?
I had quite an interest in the whole Aleutians War because it was kind of an oddity. I had looked around at different ways of getting out to Kiska, but it's prohibitively expensive if you can find someone to even take you out there. Over the years, because of my first book, I had gotten in touch with a university professor who was doing research on the decline of seabirds in the Western Aleutians. And I'd talked back and forth with him about, you know, what's the chances of getting out to Kiska besides sending my ashes out there. But after a while, he said, you know, he had a position for a field assistant. Would I be interested in going out? So, you know, of course, I jumped at the chance. The only downside was I had to spend about 8 weeks out there on the island.
Yeah. So you spent a summer there and you were kind of hiking around and studying the birds for your biology mission with your professor, and then also checking out a lot of these World War II artifacts for your own sort of personal mission. And it sounds like you found, I mean, in your book, you talk about everything from shoes and dishes and diaries to bigger things like guns and air raid shelters and the hulls of submarines and even bigger things than that. So tell me about some of the most memorable things that you stumbled across on Kiska.
Those that had the biggest impact were, I think, the personal effects of the Japanese soldier. Japanese involvement on Kiska had always been sort of a shadowy occupation. But this, you know, when you come across their toothbrushes and combs and dishes and shoes, you know, it brings home that these are, it brings home that the human side of the enemy on Kiska. There is a lot of artillery around the island, 75-millimeter guns and 6-inch guns. We came across quite a bit of this. There's still dugouts and tunnels on the island. There's the, in Kiska Harbor itself, there's the wreck of two-man submarines, actually, and various other equipment. There's also items of the American reoccupation of the island.
Sure. And so that was the Japanese Navy and the Army that were both there at kind of different areas. And then eventually the Americans landed there. And that was, of course, just after the Japanese left. But before we get to that part, I want to talk about this one particular chapter of the book. You devoted a whole chapter to the wreck of this one aircraft that you found. And it wasn't a Japanese plane. So you did some research. What did that turn out to be?
That's correct. That was a P-38 Lightning aircraft. And it was we came across that, and the site is very intact. There's a large debris field and propellers sticking out of the ground. And the most striking thing about it was the Japanese had buried the pilot there, and you know, quite a respectful grave they made, and they marked it with two sheets of aircraft metal so somebody would find this site. So we were there, and, you know, we took down the plane's serial number, and I went to the JPAC, which is a joint MIA command in Hawaii, and gave them all the particulars. Well, they came back and said, well, we have no record of that aircraft whatsoever, and so that was pretty much had reached an impasse. I looked around, and the aircraft had been listed everywhere, like from Africa to the Mideast to the Marshall Islands. But eventually, one of the researchers at the Joint MIA, about a year later, he came back and said, we found the story of this aircraft, and it was flown by Miles Werner, who's out of San Francisco. It was lost, shot down over Kiska. And the Japanese had buried the pilot. When the Americans reoccupied the island, they transferred Miles Werner to the Joint Allied Cemetery, and then he interred him down in San Francisco. But that was that's quite a touching moment when you come across something like that.
Yeah, with the propeller. I mean, you have this amazing photograph of the propeller kind of twisted, sticking out of the ground. It's really quite something. So, well, and
that's very surreal.
Yeah, definitely. So that gets into kind of the research side of this too, which really was substantial. I mean, the book it's really a combat history, a really detailed combat history of kind of the Japanese campaign and the Aleutians and, you know, Kiska especially. So how did you go about gathering all of that information to kind of put this account together?
You know, I've been looking at Kiska since about 1984, looking at charts and basically everything I could find on it. You know, initially there wasn't a lot on it because of the proximity of the Western Aleutians at the time to the Soviet Union. They, when you asked about going up there, they didn't, you know, the Coast Guard and the forces that be, they didn't want anyone really up there, up in the Western Aleutian sightseeing. And so they pretty much discouraged it. After the fall of the Iron Curtain, when you're allowed to get out there, it was still impossible to get out there. But, you know, I'd been gathering information, and then what happened was I thought, well, I'm going to write a couple of articles on this. So I did. That brought out to veterans who had been up there, and they said, hey, why don't you write a book? You know, we have all these stories and photographs and that. So I wrote the book, I got quite a good reception. That was the first book. After that, you know, I'd pretty much been gathering all this information over the years, and then all fell into place pretty much after I'd been on the island. I knew I'd wanted to write do a book of photographs, and it hadn't really been covered before, so all those years of research did pay off.
Great. So, well, I want to go briefly through the story of Kiska and then kind of ask you what it means for the larger context of World War II in the Aleutians. So basically, Kiska was taken around the same time as Attu, and that was right after the bombing of Dutch Harbor here in June of 1942. And the Japanese, it sounds like, pretty much dug in on Kiska for a little over a year. They took heavy bombings from the Americans and fired back some, and finally, the Americans kind of cut off supplies to the Western Aleutians, and there was a really bloody final battle at Attu, and they got ready for kind of the same thing on Kiska when, unbeknownst to the Americans, the Japanese had evacuated in secret about 2 weeks before the Allies landed there and found the island empty and actually exchanged some friendly fire, the Americans and the Canadians, with each other on Kiska. So knowing all that, kind of to you, what was important about Kiska in the whole scope of the Japanese campaign in the Aleutians and sort of how America had to use this as a part of their war that I think people don't really realize how much warfare happened, you know, on what would soon become American soil?
You know, the Japanese, going into the Aleutians, they were probably overreaching their capacity, because once you had those islands, now you had to hang on to them. You know, it's been cited there's different reasons, you know, as to why the Japanese went up there, and one main reason, I think, is because they were quite afraid the Americans would island hop down to Attu and Kiska and use them from which bases which to bomb Japan, which did eventually happen in the northern Kurils. In the larger context of World War II, it's really just a footnote, but it's significant in that the Japanese did grab a toehold on North America.
And what did it kind of reveal about how they conducted their war in the Aleutians? There were a lot of really interesting things in the book about the interaction between the Army and the Navy, and they were kind of doing the same things on different tracks, and sort of how the Japanese approached the landscape and kind of being here in this part of the world.
The traditionally, you know, the Japanese Navy and Japanese Army were always competing. They were competing for resources or competing for dollars. That wasn't so evident on Kiska. They seem to have a fairly good relationship on Kiska itself. But you know, the propaganda that was put out by the Japanese is, you know, they believed a lot of it, and you know, it wasn't practical, and they had an overestimation of what they could actually accomplish. You know, they spread themselves very thin all the way from northern China through the Aleutians and, you know, down as far as Australia. So it, you know, in the first 6 months of the war, they did great. But after that, you know, the tables really turned after the Midway operation, and which of course included the feint and the Aleutians.
How many people were there? I mean, how many Japanese soldiers and then Allied troops? It's really, the number was quite astounding to me, how many people were actually on that island.
Yes, it reached a high of about 7,500 troops. 1,800 of those were Army troops, and the rest were Navy troops. The Allied landing force consisted of about 35,000 troops. One thing that was significant was after Attu, what was learned on Attu, they actually expected a 75% mortality rate in retaking Kiska.
Right, and what they ended up with was, I think it was about 20 friendly casualties, and the Japanese were completely gone, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Wow. Okay, so, well, let's talk a little about the geography of the island. It's funny, the book is, it's, you know, not just a history, but also kind of a reflection on a visitor's experience in the Aleutians, a first experience in the Aleutians, and it sounds like, you know, when you're writing, you found it really isolating. There's a really nice turn of phrase. You refer to the tundra as the slow-healing tundra, and all the evidence of the trenches dug in there and the warfare that happened there. I mean, do you think that Kiska is really permanently marked by the war that took place there? What was your impression, you know, being a modern-day visitor to the island?
You know, in war, once the battle's done, there seems to be historically like little regard given to the environmental damage that's occurred. You can see that on Kiska. You know, there's the substrate is very slow to heal. You can see it. There's machinery on the shore, and it's you know, leaking oil and transmission fluid into the ground. That's quite obvious. There's a lot of ordnance still on the island. Some of that leaking picric acid, which the Japanese used. So it's, you know, things like this that you know, you sort of wonder you know, why the environment's kind of taking a back seat to the, you know, to the occupation.
Right, but I guess one of the interesting things about Kiska is there were never, I mean, there were at one point Unangan inhabitants, but they were long moved away before the war began. So it was one of the only areas where there was combat where there were no civilians, right?
That's correct, yes.
Uh-huh. And it's still uninhabited, so that's really interesting. Well, so I understand you're writing some historical fiction actually about Attu next. Are you going to be paying the Aleutians another visit for that project?
You know, I'd like to get up there for sure. I don't know if that'll happen. It's quite difficult and kind of hard to justify spending the money on it, so
yeah.
Just to go up there. But I'll try, yeah.
All right, Brendan, well, that's all the time we have for today, but thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Brendan Coyle is the author of Kiska, The Japanese Occupation of an Alaska Island. He joined me by phone today from Richmond, British Columbia.